Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about unity and scumbaggery. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, you can join us in the chat room at TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com. Is Vinny with a Y? Because it's the most important question, allegedly. Two very special guests here. One's joining me in a co-hosting capacity. It's Christopher Green, as you'll all know from Greenwave Radio. And also our guest today. We're going to be talking about some very interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. I've just had a chance to look through all of it. And I'm very keen to find out more. It's Stan Deo. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thanks, Vinny. Appreciate it. How are you today?
Somewhat fabulous, especially now that you're here, and I've just had a peruse at what we might have to talk about.
You mean life, and, death, universe, and everything?
Life, death, the universe, ancient history, the whole understanding of the number 42 and everything that entails, and the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy sense of the word. You know,
right? Well, that sounds like a good idea.
Well, the first thing. That freaking wristwatch on that, what was it, Nimrod?
Yeah, isn't that kind of bizarre? I mean, I've seen that on pictures of Marduk as well, or statues of him. And you got to wonder what it was all about, because they not only do they show him with wings, but they show him with that wristwatch on the right hand in most cases, and sometimes on the left hand. But it's like it was high technology 4,500 years ago.
Yeah, well, the wristwatch is one of the most... coveted gadgets pretty much of all time, because it's so much easier to just look at your wrist than get an out-of-pocket watch or anything like that. So it's an important measure of being able to quickly and easily keep time and keep things on schedule.
Yeah, well, his wristwatch in this old carving, or you know, stone carving, has 13, like, spikes on it, you know, going out from the center of the watch dial. And, you know, you'd think that if they were going to put jewelry on the guy, they did put a necklace on him and, you know, fancy beard with little baubles on his beard. But why a single thing like that, with that kind of shape that I've seen in other ancient carvings and statues, variations of it. It's something unusual. I don't know what it is. But I don't think it's just like normal jewelry or stuff like that.
Yeah. It's very, very strange, and it looks kind of like a flower that is strapped to his wrist almost.
Yeah, and then another thing I sent you of the Anunnaki, a tall statue of an Anunnaki guy holding a lion, but his wrist has that same kind of watch-looking thing on his right wrist, although the pattern on that one is not the same. It has some other kind of pattern, and you're like a vertical thing with a little kind of a branch.
Could it perhaps be a wrist decoration, like some people have bangles or friendship bracelets or something?
I suppose it's possible. In fact, the Anunnaki one has on both wrists, not just the right one. So I don't know. It's something that's caught my attention on a number of the ancient stela, carvings on things.
You know what they look like to me?
What?
You know, there's times when you travel and you get these sort of elastic wrist thingies that have these little indentations on the inside of the wrist, and when you're feeling a little bit car sick from traveling or something, you press them in.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah,
I remember that. Yeah. You know, I've got another one there, the Nimrod Ashurbanipal thing that I gave you. You can see him standing up in that one, and there are larger circles carved into the thing next to Nimrod, which show like, four or five, about eight spirals coming out from the center, where his watch has nine. But they're very, very frequently using this circular motif with some kind of an internal center with radiating, you know, lines or triangles or something. It's just a very common thing through all these, and you got to wonder what it is.
You do have to wonder what it is. And Chris, I'm not sure if you're actually familiar with ancient history at all, really. But one thing I'm thinking about is the fact that there's so much depictions of these creatures with wings and with pine cones, especially.
Yeah, you know, I've heard of that. I'm not too familiar with it, to be honest with you. Hey, Stan, nice to meet you.
Tell me your name again.
Well, I'm Christopher Green. I'm on the same network.
Eastwood
is. Yeah, if
I keep calling him Chris. I'm supposed to call him Christopher.
That's cool. That's cool, Vinny. I call you Vinny, and I guess I could call you Vincent too. So, do you ever go by Vincent or just Vinny?
Very few people call me Vincent.
All right, just your mother, probably.
Yeah.
Okay, good to meet you, Chris. Sorry about that, Christopher. Sorry.
Oh yeah, no problem, Dan. Jeez, Dan, you're already screwing things up, man. You've been on the show for a couple
minutes. Oh dear. What have you guys been imbibing over there?
Well, before we left the show, one of our callers called in, was asking about the fact, you know, these hookers in Colombia with the Secret Service, is this a prelude to the potential assassination of our president, Barack Hussein Obama?
I had that same thought this morning. I did wonder about it, if it's weakening the bodyguard close to the president, because he is stepping on the toes of the guys that were behind him. By, you know, not allowing the pipeline, the Alaska pipeline, to complete down in the southern leg of it. Because he was referring to his Muslim backers, you know, for the last election, and they wanted that closed so that we would buy their oil. But you have to wonder, something big's going down, I reckon.
Yeah, it doesn't smell right. I mean, it would be, I don't know, are you in the States, Stan, or are you out in New Zealand, or where are you at?
Neptune.
All right.
No, really. I'm in the States in Colorado, beautiful Colorado, okay. In a place called Pueblo West next to a large lake.
Okay. Well, I was just saying, you know, obviously I hope nothing like that would ever happen. But, I mean, that'd be catastrophic. I mean, I don't like Obama. I don't like his politics. But, I mean, that would be horrible for the country. What was that?
It'd throw us into chaos, Chris.
Oh, yeah, we think things are bad now. I mean, it would be legitimately chaotic. I mean, it would not be a good thing. I mean, it's the last thing that we'd want to see. Talk about complete destabilization.
Right.
We'd be in trouble.
The whole world would be. It would just set the whole world into trouble.
Vinny, what's your thoughts, outside perspective? Any talk of that, you know, in and around your circles or...
No, not really. I mean, it's just basically New Zealanders are very conservative that way, sex and all that sort of stuff, you know, just not too much of an interest.
Oh, you just don't talk about it. It happens down there.
Yeah. Well, if Obama was killed, I mean, if that did happen, he would be whacked. I mean, I wouldn't believe for a second that it was some kind of a random event, which is what they always like to sell to us. No, if something happened, it was because the powers that be that put him in power decided they don't need him anymore. And, to fulfill the agenda, they'd get rid of him. I mean, hey, isn't that how the mob works? I mean, how is this any different, mainstream politics in America today?
You know, that's a battle of the titans up there, and I think he's biting the hand that holds his leash in a number of areas. And, you know, I think he believes that with the Islamic backing from the Middle East that he can do no wrong and that they'll protect him. But, you know, I have my doubts. Chris, where are you located?
I'm out in Phoenix, Arizona.
Well, you're just south of me a bit.
Yeah, just south of you. Great state of Arizona. I like it out here. Pretty conservative, you know, I would say, but we got a good group, good mix of people, got a lot of California transplants. I'm originally from California.
You're the guys that made the prices of real estate rise out there. You didn't ask, you just bought, didn't you?
Well, not me personally, but yeah, with it, I would say a lot of Californians are responsible for that. I mean, for sure. You know, that was a part of that crazy boom, you know, huge credit expansion, everybody and their brother was a mortgage broker, and it totally decapitated our real estate market. I mean, literally, some homes are off 80, 90% since the peak. I mean, it has absolutely been Armageddon here. Wow. We're starting to see some buyer activity now, of course. I mean, you know, things are back, prices are back down to reality. So we've got a lot of cash buyers. I think we're seeing this across the country. A lot of investors, 40, 50%. Cash buyers, if not more, a lot of people out of state, buying these homes, fixing them up, and you know, they seem to be doing okay. So there's been some stabilization after the massacre. You know, everyone's been through foreclosure or short sale, is on the streets. If you've got any credit left, yeah, it might be a good time to buy a house.
we joke about the Californian invasion that occurred, 15 years back, I guess. But it's called the Californication of the state of Colorado. And I suppose that's happened to you down there. But
yeah, it has.
Our prices here, where we are, have dropped somewhere between 30% and 50% on most of the homes in the area where we are, with about 20,000 homes here.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Not quite as bad as some of these areas, Arizona, you know, Nevada, Florida. People are very familiar with this because it's been in the news. But yeah, it's been pretty rough. The other thing people don't realize too is that Phoenix, Scottsdale, very much a service-oriented economy. We had a ton of realtors, ton of mortgage people, ton of finance people. I even myself come from the finance world. So when all that unraveled, really hit our local economy hard. You know, we've got a lot of money out here too. I mean, there's a lot of retirees, a lot of people, you know, that have second, third homes out here. So it's a different, you know, it's a different economy. There's not really any manufacturing, anything like that. So we were hit hard along with the rest of the country.
Do you remember reading anything about Phoenix settling, like dropping down a bit in altitude because of the depletion of the water table underneath Phoenix?
You know, I don't know. I'm not too familiar with that. I've heard about that. But yeah, I don't really have a good answer for you.
Both Phoenix and Las Vegas, I think, share the same problem. And, you know, if that aquifer is totally drained, you're sitting on top of a fragile kind of cavity that might collapse.
Well, I know if we don't have water, we're screwed. I mean, same thing with California. You know, if you look at Orange County, I mean, if the water gets cut off, it's a desert.
Well, it comes from Colorado.
Exactly.
I love what Bill Hicks said about Los Angeles, is that there'll be a great act of God that will break it off and flush it into the bowl of the Pacific like the turd city it is, and all that will be left will be a calm, peaceful serenity called Arizona Bay.
Yeah, that's a great commercial. Come visit Arizona.
Yeah, you know, the Hopi, we've been down and been their guest a couple times down there, and they have told us that before all this changes are finished in the near future, that the water will actually run as high as the coastlines of the three mesas, and they will go between the mesas in boats. Now, that takes a 5,000-foot drop. That's pretty severe.
Yeah, well, I don't know what your thoughts are, Stan, on the whole 2012 stuff, but I mean, they say, yeah, we're supposed to get what, east of the Rocky Mountains is where you're supposed to be?
Well, I would say that regardless, because of the increasing earthquakes and volcanoes all along the West Coast, and the East Coast is going to happen, plus up to New Madrid. America's going to be in Hurt City real soon on a lot of fronts, and you know, in Colorado, the Rockies on the eastern slopes, and probably south of Denver, but north of Trinidad, I think would probably be fairly good place to settle. Even the Hopi told us that they're going to leave their three mesas. And when I did a plot of their area showing the water level rise that would have to fulfill their prophecies, it can either be from Arizona dropping down and the West Coast dropping down, or it can be from a blockage, say a large earthquake at a dam, which would cause the water to back up into the plateau just underneath the three mesas and would flood it. And in that event, it would take, I did the calculations, it would take like 25 years for it to fill up. So that's probably not what they're looking at. But it did show that there would be a land bridge from the mesas back up into Colorado that they could follow. And they told me that they're going to migrate back up into Colorado to the Four Corners region. And that's where they will start the new tribe of man after all the civil fight, you know, civil war fighting here in the United States and the invasion by one or two powers that will absolutely decimate most of the country. So Colorado seems to be where it's all going to be resolved, where what's left will gather.
So what is the Hopi? What are, you know, where are they getting their information? Why are they making these decisions? You know, is it a spiritual guidance? Or
it's a spiritual thing and prophecy that they've carried down. What they do, not very much of this is written down in the past, and they've had actually about 1,000 years ago, I think it was the last visit of Masa'u, or God, in his flying craft. And things were imparted to them then that they only pass word of mouth to the tribal elders. Now, some things have come since then in, I guess, vision quests of some sort, because they do hold a lot of meetings in their underground, like Kiva. And I talked to, Holly and I both visited with senior prophecy tellers or wise men that keep this kind of stuff. And they only told us this much because I came to them and showed them something about the earthquakes and volcanoes on my computer, which fit in with their prophecies. And while I'm sitting right there with them, the keeper of these secrets started telling everybody in the tribe, here's new information. Now I can tell you now that he's shown me this. Strange stuff is happening.
That's for sure.
All right. Chris, thank you for joining us. I mean, if you have time for another segment, you're welcome to stay.
Yeah, thanks, Vinny. You know what? I do have to run, but I really appreciate you having me on and graciously appearing on our show. Stan, nice to meet you. We'll have to have you on our program sometime soon.
Sure, Chris. Sounds good.
Okay. Thanks, Vinny.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you get friggin' nuts, man. I mean, seriously.
Hey, are you still there? I mean, is New Zealand still intact? It hasn't blown up yet?
Unfortunately not.
They could start with government there in Auckland, couldn't they?
Well, you see, I'd always thought that the one benefit Parliament could be to the people is it could be benefit the people by being burnt down. You know why? Because all the people that the Parliament have made homeless would be able to gather around it and warm their hands at least.
Well, no, that's true. That's true. Whatever happened to that plan that Parliament had of moving Parliament House 100 feet one direction or the other a few years back?
I don't know. They probably got lazy and in the old-fashioned New Zealand way just went, oh, she'll be right, mate, and just couldn't be bothered.
Probably so. Goodness gracious. When I heard that, I couldn't believe it. I forget, it was like $100 million or something to move it, you know, just so many feet to the east or west. And I thought, well, why are they even bothering?
Well, we did just move an older building that's owned by the former mayor of Auckland that's worth kind of like a huge amount of money in order to make way for a new tunnel that was built by a contracting company that's partly owned by the government that got a no-bid contract.
I see. I followed all that too. Yes. Interesting.
I love New Zealand. Like, the corruption's just straight up in your face, you know? It's not even hard to dig for it. It's just people don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Hey, you know, when I was down there with Holly in 1996, I think it was, I'd had that dream vision about Taupo crater erupting, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and it was really quite vivid and detailed. And so I came over and I was there. I hadn't told anybody in New Zealand about it, and I got a call from the Art Bell Show up here in the States, and they said, where are you? We want to talk to you. And I told them what I was doing and what I'd seen, and apparently a lot of New Zealanders listened to the Art Bell Show, the coast-to-coast thing that night. And people started calling, getting all excited about, you know, Taupo going to erupt right that minute. And actually, what happened after we'd finished all that show, the next day, the New Zealand Department of Tourism asked me never to come back. It was hurt tourism.
What, did they give you a ring or send you a letter?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, they gave me a ring. We'd appreciate if you wouldn't come back. So
you're freaking out the locals, man.
Well, and the potential, you know, money spenders and tourists. I mean, I've seen, I'm sure you've seen the videos of that turkey that was skiing down the backside of Ruapehu when it was starting to spit stones and erupt a little bit here a few years back. I mean, this is the kind of madness that, that we have to deal with off the almighty dollar, I guess.
Hey, well, New Zealand is a place full of people who are really not very cautious, I'd say. You know, well, they don't. It's more like a we're here and we can do something, so let's do it. Let's not come up with reasons not to.
Ah. Well, they could take a lesson from the hobbits down there in South Island, couldn't they? Just smoke.
Oh, they could.
Yeah, enjoy life. Yeah, kick back.
And smoke some pipe weed.
Well, I did see that, yes. You can blow beautiful mosaics in the air with that pipe weed.
Yeah, I'm still working on being able to blow a ship through a smoke ring.
Yes, well, that takes a bit of talent, and sometimes you have to use another orifice to get that kind of shape.
Yes, indeed. I mean, one, perhaps two nostrils might be employed.
So. Oh, that's it. Yes, that's it.
I cleaned that up, Stan.
Yeah, you did. I'm shame on me. Yes.
Well, let's not pretend that we're all highbrow here. I mean, what was it on the last show? The question that we're asking the callers is, would you do Barack Obama and why?
Oh, really? What a novel idea. I wish more Americans had thought of that.
Well, apparently some ladies do.
Yes, yes, yes.
None that I know of. But in order for any woman to be stupid enough to vote for him, there seriously must be something other than her mind thinking about it. I mean, and for any guy to do it, I just can't understand it. In fact, I can't understand why anybody would vote for him, like lock, stock, and barrel. I don't care what spectrum of the XYZ chromosome family you managed to be spurted out with.
Well, you know, I wondered about this last election, whether the Acorn group that obviously have been working for him in the grassroots, since they were handling so many of the voters going to the polls, if they didn't have some way to fudge the vote, because it just didn't make sense that, you know, that he won. And now then we're approaching an election where he's been in for 3.5 years or so and could have excessive control over the whole digital voting thing, and he transfers it over to Spain to some company over there to handle out of the country to count the votes. So I'll tell you, if we have a fair election, I will be very surprised, you know, no matter what the outcome of it is. So,
oh yeah, there's no such thing as a free election in any Western nation anymore. I firmly believe that the political process has been 100% completely rotted, and even if there is a real candidate, they will be demonized, cut out of the media, and the votes will be flipped or miscounted to make sure that they don't win and that some other douchebag does.
Yeah, well, now then, with the powers that be behind Obama being really, really mad at him because of this pipeline deal, you got to wonder what's going to happen, whether they'll just make him lose the election, or whether they'll put up another, you know, support Romney or something like that, or whether Obama's going to go down. I don't know, but something
Obama will win. Obama will win.
Yeah, but whether he stays alive or not is another thing. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, he'll win for the same reason John Key from the National Party just won the election down here in New Zealand. Because they're an economic hitman that was sent there to destroy the country, and they ain't finished yet. Hence, they're going to get reelected.
Well, as long as he follows his advisors, which he's tending to break with in favor of the American advisors anyway, in favor of the Islamic advisors out of the Middle East with the oil, I'm going to be very interested to see who he has as his vice presidential running mate, if he keeps the same one who's an idiot, or whether he replaces him with someone that could take his place in a real emergency.
What madman in the Middle East wants to war with Iran? For America to go to war with Iran? I mean, because the whole region would just turn to smizzle, wizzle, or some other kind of Yiddish word for horrible crap storm.
Well, you know, I think that we have no choice, really, the rest of the world, not just America, but the Western world has no choice because Iran is definitely building nuclear weapons and probably bought some. Iran is so close, and so is their ally at Syria and on the north side of Israel there on the border in the Golan Heights, you know, from Syria. They're so close that if they launched a missile, even a small 10-kiloton thing, Israel could not stop it in time. It would be there and explode, and if it were nothing more than an EMP, it would just almost collapse Israel. So Israel is going to have to make a decision here shortly somehow to disrupt Iran's progress and Syria as well, who are helping them, which is going to force the Russians to come down in and honor their Middle East agreements with Syria, with Iran. And the rest of the world out here cannot sit by and do nothing. We're going to be pulled into it one way or the other. And Obama's talking to Benjamin Netanyahu in the press saying, well, will you hold off attacking Iran until after the election? Let me get settled here. I don't know that that's, you know, a real issue. That I think it's just a ploy by Obama to try to make Israel do nothing and get attacked. Israel's not.
And not to mention, that doesn't make any sense because traditionally speaking, if you start a war before an election, you'll get elected.
Yeah, but you don't want to be seen, I think, probably as starting it. You want to be seen as forced into it. Well, gosh, it happens. I'll have to do this, folks. We'll have to go into war. And it could even stop the elections in a time of national emergency if we had a false flag nuclear hit on America right now. I mean, there's so many potential options in this, it's not funny.
Well, that's the interesting thing about trying to predict New World Order activity is because they've got so many schemes in the meat grinder at the same time, you don't know which one's actually going to wind up coming and get you. It's like you shoot a guy and then he runs into a burning house that's got heaps of really hazardous chemicals burning in there, and then one of them explodes and he's inhaling the toxic fumes and a beam drops on him and it's burning and then the house goes up in smoke. What killed him?
Yeah, who knows? You're still dead.
Exactly. The methodology matters not. We know what the game plan is. The end result is that guy's going to die anyway.
Yeah.
So we know that a war with Iran is on. What methodology that they're going to use in order to implement it, I think, is a moot point. How to expose the agenda for the war with Iran, who benefits, what's the point to it on the other hand, and figuring out where the money's actually going, what their agenda is, and the World War III and the outcome of that, and the knock-on effects and what have you. That's what I'm interested in, Stan.
You know, Vinny, years ago when I was recruited by the Illuminati to work down on a project there in Australia with flying saucers and stuff. And as part of my job there, I did get to have lunch a couple of times with the old cotton tops that were in charge of it at the round table down there. And one of the things that came out that I suddenly understood in those conversations was that the Illuminists on the Western Illuminists have been trying to win the Crusades after, you know, the 13th Crusade failed and Saladin, you know, killed all the knights that were there and whatever and took Jerusalem back. There was a determined effort. It's been ongoing based in England and then, of course, the United States and now in Australia and probably part of it in New Zealand. All of it aimed at depleting the oil in the Middle Eastern Islamic countries because that's where they're getting their money, you know, to make war and to try to Islamize the Western world. And so it's really a religious kind of holy war that the Illuminists are fighting against the Islamic forces. And quite honestly, what they're trying to do is either burn the oil fields or use it all up while keeping our own reserves in the West buried or out of sight so that we can then control the world economy through the use of that oil because the Middle East, you know, the Islamic oil producers will be out of oil or destitute and can't do it anymore. This kind of logic is what's behind the whole Illuminati operation. And in one point, I can look at this and say, well, I don't want to live under Sharia law. And so if this is our only option, then I would have to support that, you know, that viewpoint and stop them. But the whole Middle East is the Balkan powder keg. Like for World War I, it's the Balkan powder keg of World War III. And how do you do this when the Islamic nations over there, the oil-producing countries, the OPEC, know what you're doing and are trying to stop you. It's no longer a secret. It's out in the open.
Why is Iran perceived as a threat when they've never attacked anyone in 300 years?
Iran is perceived as a threat because they have been judiciously and effectively building underground nuclear facilities that will allow them to not only produce nuclear energy, but to produce nuclear weapons. And the leader of them at the moment, Ahmadinejad, has said, I want to destroy Israel. I am going to destroy Israel. They are the enemy. We're going to wipe them off the face of the map. He leaves no doubt when he says, I'm going to get rid of them. And
because I'm not sure if that's true, Stan, because I've heard the recording of that, and that's kind of not what he said. Israel being wiped off the map was a conclusion of what would happen, and he said that Israel would do it to itself because of how it treats everybody.
I don't know that we're talking about the same interview, but okay. You say, why are people afraid of him? Because he's building the nuclear weapons. And if you look at the concentration of nuclear power plants up until 20 years ago, it was all Western nations. They didn't go over to those OPEC countries. And now then they're just starting to get. I wrote about this in the Cosmic Conspiracy, and I listed the countries and saying, look, this is a one-sided thing where the Western nations have been trying to prevent the Middle East and the OPEC group from obtaining nuclear power. They want them to depend on the oil to deplete that, and then they'll have nothing left to develop any other power, and they'll be, in essence, destroyed politically and religiously from getting into the rest of the Western world. Believe me, this is a religious holy war that's underneath all this. We have power in the Western world, energy devices that are not released to the public for very good reasons. Part of this, burn up the oil over in the Middle East first so that we control the planet. These devices, they're virtually free energy. You have to build the hardware to collect it, and that costs you a little bit, but nothing compared to the energy you'll get out of the environment. It's not being released because it's not time yet, according to the Illuminists. They want to destroy the Sharia law nations in the OPEC countries, so they can't force that on the Western world. Believe it. It's just unbelievable to realize that.
Does this an agenda across the entire Islam? Like they'd probably have to put Indonesia on the hit list. It's the most populous Muslim nation on earth, which is right next door to Australia and New Zealand. So it's a global thing, ladies and gentlemen. And they're playing chess, not checkers. We'll be right back with Stan Deo after the break.
There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about just a little bit of history repeating. It's Reichstag fire time. Bring it back. It's on like Donkey Kong. False flags. Oh, yeah, you got to love them. Like, you know what I want to do? Is I want to get like some of that black flag fly spray. You got that in the States, don't you, Stan?
Yep.
Yeah. And just rebrand it as false flag fly spray.
You're evil.
you know, you can go around killing flies with a false flag.
I tell you what, I don't know what you put in that first cup of coffee, but you're away, son. You're away.
Oh my God, I'm cracking myself up today.
Oh, Lord. I tell you what, you do have to laugh these days. There's just so much heavy stuff happening that we need to laugh.
Maybe I'm trying too hard to laugh at these things, Stan.
Well, you know, Holly and I, we do laugh at some of these things. And a lot of the time it's just laugh and disbelief. I mean, can you believe the stupidity of, you know, this or that person or the public doing this? And in the end, you just kind of want to go out there and sit on the back deck next to a little bit of a fire and some wine and say, well, it's a nice evening out there, isn't it? Just forget it. But the humor does help relieve some of the tension that builds up when you see what's happening. And obviously you do. I mean, that's why your show has the format it does, where you inject the humor to try to not make people want to go out and cut their wrists when they see what's happening. You know, there is really kind of some hope, I think, somewhere there. And that's what you're trying to do in your own way with the humor.
Yeah, I think it's therapy for all of us, you know. I mean, it's therapeutic for me to cackle about stuff. If other people join me in and said cackle, that's good. But I know most of the time it's just me laughing.
Oops, that'd be the phone.
Yeah. Well, I'll take that off the hook there, Stan.
yes.
Yeah, okay, all of those little technical difficulties. It always happens.
Yes. Our secret's out. We're Skyping instead of phoning.
Yes. Well, the whole show's been done from day one via Skype, and what we've done is quite significant here at American Freedom Radio, as we've managed to turn a free program into a broadcasting platform so that you can have international talk radio show hosts and guests from virtually anywhere in the world on air for free, which keeps running costs down significantly and allows for a very high quality audio stream broadcast, because the majority of the time, if you are doing an audio only stream of Skype, the audio will in general be a lot higher quality than even a phone conversation.
Is that
especially
right?
If you have the right microphone.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. I've got one of those neat microphones like you've got, with a little, you know, spit screen in front of it and stuff, but I've never figured out how to hook it up to my computer yet. So,
you've got to buy a sound card, man. Also, this is another interesting tip for anybody who's a budding radio show host. You can get these sound cards from electronic stores and stuff like that. Microphone jacks into the front, and a USB comes out the back. So you just put it into your computer, and your computer automatically recognizes it if you've got a Mac, and it's like just a USB sound device, so you can turn that into your microphone for your Skype or for any of your other recording programs that you wanted to do, or if you want to do like a webcast, if you want to broadcast to people and that kind of thing, you can use it for that. So in general, the higher quality audio and video that you have, it's the better it is in general. But if you're doing it every day like me, it can start to soak up a heck of a lot of room on your hard drives with all the videos and stuff. I mean, I've got stacks of terabyte hard drives that are just full with Vinnie Eastwood shows and videos and all of this other stuff that I've made over the years.
Wow, I can see that, because I have the recording going on my Skype too, and of course if you've got video on it, it just eats up disk space like crazy. You're looking at 2 or 3 gigabytes per day. And that adds up to a lot of terabytes before long.
Oh yeah, and of course there's extra versions of all the things that we do. Like if you've subscribed to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, you can go to the subscriber videos page. You can see it there on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. And if you can't see it, and slightly inept, but I love you anyway. Just send me an email and I'll give you the link to it. So you can subscribe and give $5 a month or whatever, or not. You can just listen to the archives that are commercial free if you really, really want to. But in general, yeah. Because I think that doing lots of extra versions of stuff, Stan, kind of adds value a little bit for people.
You know, Vinny, it does. And I'm sitting here thinking back to my youth, and I'm quite a bit older than you, but I was around in Dallas when IBM was just releasing the 1401 computer. And to us, a big CPU was 12K, and we had tape drives where a whole tape would hold maybe a megabyte, And we had disk drives that were spun up, you know, they were big disk drives. They were like 3 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot. And,
holy cow!
You know, yeah, yeah. That was way before your time, but good gracious, those were big. And we were so proud, you know, chuffed that we're working on a 12K CPU with 1 megabyte storage per tape drive. We had 4 tape drives and, you know. Now, I mean, goodness gracious,
I've
your phone.
I've got a pen drive in front of me that was like $60 or something like that. It's got 32 gigabytes.
I know. It's disgusting. It really is. And they tell me eventually they're going to be able to put some kind of an implant in your brain, which you can have your CPU storage and online, and you just, I don't know, you pull on your earlobe or something and it plays for you. I don't know how they'd work it, but they were seriously talking about implanting that kind of power in your brain.
Maybe you need to give it a dirty wink in order to get it to play.
Yes, that might work too.
You know, some girl would get really upset. You're like, what are you doing? It's just like, oh, I'm just watching porn.
Oh, it'd be bad. I know that they're
I've got a dirty mind today.
Yeah, I hear that. But, you know, they've got glasses that are a version of what the military's had in their heads-up displays where they could actually put a fiber optic into your glasses, which would focus the signal, you know, the video straight into your eyeball, so that in essence you would see floating in your eye the heads-up display. But now they want to do that with computing, and so that you can interact with your computer through what you're seeing in that thing that goes in your glasses. It puts it straight into your eyeball. I mean, doesn't
they're going to call that an iPhone?
Oh, are they? Well, that how original. But we're already in the
eye. I'm joking. I saw it on Futurama.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, they'll have to figure something different because I and EYE are going to be overlapping.
Yeah.
And Jobs will turn over in his grave, so.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. You know, in fact, Steve Jobs, one of my favorite quotes from him is, "Let's be pirates."
Yeah?
Yeah. That was one of the biggest motivational speeches he ever gave to Apple, like back in the 80s and stuff like that, when the new Mac was coming out in 1984. There's a big convention, all these programmers and everything like that. He comes out and he's straight up, you know, let's be pirates, man. Let's just go for it. Let's just take everything we can out of this market. Let's grow. Let's grab ideas from this there and everything. Let's be pirates.
Really? Well, I guess I could explain the horrific success that they've had.
Oh, yeah.
Still, you know, I mean, the Windows or the PC environment is still the elephant in the room. I mean, you can't beat them with what shares that Apple has of the market, but maybe that'll change in time.
I think Apple's kind of diversifying out, because what's happening now, I think, is people are seeing Apple as more of a fashion rather than just a technology piece. And I'm starting to see now that a lot of the people that I know that use their computers for working, you know, doing media or professional tools, things like that, are starting to go to the big Apple desktop computers. But those who are very serious about IT and gaming and other things like that, they want PCs because that you can build and pick and mix them and that sort of thing. Whereas people who want Macs, they just want stuff that works and doesn't fail on you, and you don't really need to know too much about them.
Hey, that's me. I started out with PCs and switched to Macs. I mean, you know, I got out of the stage where I used to be programming and doing all that kind of stuff because it was just too hard to keep up with it all. And now then, of course, with the Mac, it's virtually bulletproof for most of us that just want to get the job done, don't want to know about the tweaking of it.
Yeah, exactly. Who wants 1,000 options when you just want one thing that will work?
Right, right. I've switched a number of our clients over to using Apple and just shown them what the benefits were, because they're in business to sell their own products and don't want to be bothered with all the constant hassles and having an IT person, all that kind of stuff. They can do it themselves now.
And IT people are terrible people persons, man. Oh, my God.
They lock them up in the back room, don't they?
Oh, and for good reason. You know, I'm surprised that more dog collars don't exist in IT rooms, you know.
Yeah, that would solve some of the problem, wouldn't it? A little shocker collar.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's another company that should be started up somewhere. Somebody, you know, here's a free idea for you. Shock collars for your nerd in the office, okay? Everybody can have a clicker just in case. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with more shocking stories from Stan Deo.
Pollution, gathering dust particles, funneling through smokestacks, airwaves, bandwidth, disinformation too fed. Check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. The Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's hour number two, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. The reason why it's so fast is because we're all having fun, and you'd be surprised how fast time flies when you do that. My very special guest, Stan Deo. And one thing I've figured, Stan, is that everybody, particularly in the truth movement, they have happy lives and all of that kind of stuff, but a lot of it actually does involve a lot of hard work, and everybody's got their problems of this, that, or the age. There's money, or your body might be given out on you, or every truth has got something that's a bit of a pain for them. And I just like to bring people on the show to just cheer you up or whatever. Not that you need cheering up, but just, you know, who needs an excuse to have fun?
Well, that's true. That's true. And certainly I've had experiences in life, as I'm sure you have, that are really worth a hoot. You were mentioning one that you were going to talk about during the break, a story.
Oh, yeah. My sister Cherie, her husband, Jono, he works down in Christchurch, right? He's back in the days in IT help desk, and gets a call from this guy. And he's sort of a little bit upset that it's a brand new computer and it's not working. All right, so he's like, okay. So what's wrong with it? And he says, oh, it just won't turn on. He's like, okay. Has the power supply? Yep. Cable's connected, yep. Is it plugged in? Like, no. Okay. So, right. Do you have a lawnmower? He's like, what? Yeah, I do. Okay, so you got some two-stroke petrol down the in the shed out there? He's like, yeah, okay. Portable phone? Yep, all right. So what I want you to do, grab the phone and the computer, and I want you to go out to your backyard. Okay? All right, sweet as. So yeah, the backyard, cool. You got your two-stroke petrol? He's like, yep. Okay, now I want you to pour it on your computer. Because you should not be using it.
And the point was made.
Yeah. It's just the funny thing is about computers and all this technical skills, and I teach a lot of people how to use stuff, because to me it appears very simple, and I'm capable of explaining things in a very simplistic way that help people understand pretty quickly. And I teach a lot of, in some cases, elderly, some cases, just children or whatever, how to use stuff, because normally it's just like you click that, blah 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 blah. It's done when it appears to be an incredibly complicated process. For me, it's just a process of copy paste.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, we have so many people, like we have a couple of e-books, electronic books. And so many of them do not read in big, bold letters and red on the cart where they buy these things. This is an electronic book. You have to run it on your computer. And they will email or phone, what's wrong with this? You know, and it doesn't work. And you say, well, where are you doing this? Well, I load it down on my computer, and it's just sitting there. Did you try to open the file? Well, how do you do that? And, you know, you click on it, double click on it, you know, a right click, and it unfolds itself, and you can then see it. Oh, I see. Where is it on my computer? where is it? And then Holly has a CD-ROM, you know, CD-ROM, not DVD, CD-ROM. It's not a CD music thing. And we have had so many people over the years that call up and say, I put it into my car's player, and all I get is these screechy noises. It must be a defective disc. You know, you're thinking maybe you don't need that Prudent Places USA disc. You know, that we're taking you out of the gene pool. You're just too dumb to live. You know,
it's
unbelievable.
It's the Darwin Awards all over again, you know. I mean, yeah. One of my mates was working for GE Money, and this person was calling in screaming about how their application form wasn't sent out properly, and then it only allowed him to put down half his details. And he says, did you turn the page over? And he heard this, oh.
Unbelievable.
Come on. I mean, it's like, it's almost like we need to put instructions on airplane peanuts these days, you know, open packet, eat nuts.
I know. It's just unbelievable, the stupidity that's out there. It's like dumbed down where you can't do anything for yourself anymore. If it's not kind of done for you, it doesn't happen.
There is a benefit to all this, though. God, it's funny.
Well, yeah. They do provide that.
You know, maybe, Stan, maybe the New World Order are actually building the kind of world that I can enjoy. A world where you just kind of, you walk around as sort of like this, a guy who's smarter than the rest of these idiots and just laugh at the stupidity.
You could run the Matrix, couldn't you?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Can't be that bad.
I know.
Just involves just... extermination of mankind.
Yeah, minor detail, but yeah, goodness gracious. Holly and I have days where we absolutely cackle. You know, we'll put it on mute if we're on the phone and cackle. Can you believe what we're hearing on this phone or emails, you know? And it does provide levity, let me tell you. Mm.
Yeah. And I think it's when you're open to it. Because the people I really don't enjoy the company of, Stan, are people who just won't laugh at anything. They won't make jokes. They won't make light of anything. Everything's 100% serious for them, or it's like that for long stints kind of thing. And then occasionally there's a joke or something. Because I think everything in sales, this is what I learned in sales, is that when you say things with a smile, people can hear it with a smile, and it processes with a smile in their brain with a smile.
Right.
And it makes you happier no matter what you're talking about.
Well, you know, it's my style of like delivering lectures and things like that, or interviews, is basically, you know, I'll tell an event or relate a circumstance, and, you know, probably myself will be the benefit or the brunt of the joke, but it does get a laugh, but it's kind of the way I talk, you know, the way you do too. I mean, it's just, in fact, it's what's called elliptical humor when you make yourself the brunt of it. It's a Jewish trait in telling jokes on yourself, but
the self-hating Jewish comedy.
Self-deprecating. Yes, it's true.
It's one of the most safest forms of comedy, and I think that's why Chris Rock gets away with it, you know, because he makes some very disparaging comments about the black community, but because he's black, it's funny.
He can get away with it. That's right. Yeah. You know, there's method to that madness. It really is.
I've got to start making fun of more white people, Stan, I've got to tell you.
Oh, the crackers.
Yeah. Crackers and cheese.
Yeah. You know... We were talking in the break there, a couple breaks back, just about things that are funny. And I remember, you know, getting petrified over in a dig I was in the Middle East on the Dead Sea there, just south of where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And I was in the cave of the Wadi Hakipa, which means the cave which has a rabbi's hat. And I'd been sent there, I'd been given a map by Dr. Jones, Mendel Jones, and he's a family friend, so he gave me the secret map to get into his digs there. And you had to go up to this cave, and it had a hole in the top of it, like the bald spot on a rabbi, and it's kind of dome-shaped like a head, so they call it the cave, or the Wadi Hakipa.
Did it have curly sideburns as well?
More like rocky slopes, but yeah, I guess it could have been curly sideburns. But I had to reach up behind this rock, stand on tiptoes, and reach behind it and find a rope that was hidden there and pull it out. And it was connected to a support somewhere up inside the cave, and use that to pull myself up the side of the thing, the pile of dirt and rocks that were in front of the cave, so I could get into the mouth of the cave. And once I got in there, then I had to sit down in the middle of the floor underneath that hole in the top and wait for the sun to hit it about 11:30, 12 midday, so that it would put a white spot down on the cave floor. And Dr. Jones told me that's where you need to move several inches of dirt and sand away, and you'll find a flat metal plate there that you need to move, and you can go down and see the room that I found, the old priest were using. And so I thought, okay, yeah, and I did that, and I moved the plate out of the way, and sure enough, there was a hole down there with a ladder, and I went down the ladder into the darkness, and I thought, uh-oh, I left my flashlight back in Jerusalem. This is not going to be good. I didn't think about that. So then it was get the matches out, and me and my mate, we both went down the hole, and you strike a match, and you look around, okay, and then the match is gone. Well, I knew I was standing on a ledge underneath that ladder, and the ledge was about as wide as, 10 inches, where if your heel's back against the wall, your toes are hanging over the edge of dirt and rock. So I was inching down in the dark because I wanted both hands free to, break my fall if I fell down to wherever it led. And it was up above something down there because I threw a rock over the side and went, pow, 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 and I knew that it was deep. Well, probably two stories, something like that. So I'm inching down this wall. My friends ahead of me on the ledge going down. We're talking in the dark, and I become aware of something warm and pulsating on my shoulder. It had landed there. I thought, oh, goodness, tarantula? What? And so I reached up with my gloved hand and knocked it off, and it went sailing off over the side, and I heard, pow! I thought, well, that's the end of that one. I hope there's no more. So we get down, and we find that there's a ramp at the end of this ledge that we were balanced on, and we walk down the ramp with some of our matches. We only had a few, half a box or so, and we see where we're supposed to go in to look at this chamber that's hidden down at the bottom behind another metal sheet. And you have to kneel down and crouch into it, almost in a fetal position, but vertically, to get to see inside the room that they'd excavated. So I'm down in there, and I've got my Indy Jones hat on, the brimmed hat and all that kind of stuff. And it's the top of that was just about hitting the top of the little hole I had to get into. And I felt, again, this warm, vibrating presence on my hat at the top. And I thought, gee, I forgot about that. This thing must have gotten down and climbed on my hat. So I get out of there, and I tell my mate, turn on your light a match and let me see what's on my head. And he starts laughing, and it's a bat. Yeah, and so there I was in the middle of a bunch of bat guano and a bat on my head and feeling very stupid, but I let him go and then proceeded to look into the chamber where the priest had built these two stacks of white stones and black stones, and I was looking at something that was probably 2,000 years old, never been seen, and it was a beautiful sight. I mean, the room was probably 20 foot by 20 foot, and it was carved out of the rock, but the ceiling had been plastered and put big round stones in it. And the stones are like some of them 8 to 12 inches in diameter, nice smooth river roll stones from the Jordan River. But what was really neat was in that flickering match light, there were diamonds all between all of the stones that were sparkling. That's the first impression. It's diamonds. It's the whole ceiling was just glistening with these jewels. And it was gypsum that had leached out of the dead sea water they'd used to make the mortar to put those stones up. And over the centuries, it had leached out and made these big, beautiful crystals. So I got over my being ashamed of the fear of the bat and was just absolutely awestruck by what I saw there. It's beautiful. Anyway, that's the end of that story. My mate and I got out and we went over to there's two caves up and went into that one, and a little more light in there at the opening, but we walked in and there were big bones, like femur bones, laying all over the floor of this cave. It looked rather fresh. And the deeper in it we got, some of our built-in signals that tell you danger is near started to, your hair in the back of your neck starts to crawl. And I realized there was some kind of an animal, probably a cat, in there hiding in some of the rocks over to the side, and there was like humidity in the air where it shouldn't be. It's all dry outside, so we realized that we were being kind of watched by something that probably look at us as lunch, and we decided to leave. And not ashamed of that again. It's discretion's a better part of valor. There, you can have fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you also told us a story over the break about what was it? The real Indiana Jones, who you knew.
Yeah, Dr. Jones lived in Arlington, Texas. He's now passed away, but he was a family friend of, you know, of my dad and mine. And his real name was Dr. Vendel Jones, and V-E-N-D-Y-L. And his nickname, was, of course, was Vendy. He didn't like it much because it rhymed with Wendy, and, you know, kind of guessed the derivative of why he was nicknamed that. But anyway, he was a Bible scholar supreme. He was a translator supreme, and he was working on locating the lost Ark of the Covenant for many years. And he had gotten a hold of copies of what's called the Copper Scrolls. They were written in Hebrew or punched in Hebrew on a copper sheet with lambskin underneath it so they could press on it and make these indentations. And it was a map. Now, I've got copies of it. We're working on it. But anyway, Dr. Jones spent many times over in Israel excavating, looking for where he thought the Ark of the Covenant was, and finally located from the Copper Scrolls this Wadi HaKippah cave down near the Dead Sea, right on the shore there. And he was right about certain things there that he did find. He found a big rolling rock that came running down, just like in the Indiana Jones series. In fact, he was telling me once that one of the diggers that had come volunteered to help him excavate this cave years before the Indiana Jones series made the books and TV and movies and stuff, that this digger was there when this big rolling stone got dislodged and came rolling at him, just like in the movies. And he was there to hear Dr. Jones, the real Dr. Jones, say, I hate spiders or snakes or whatever. And this guy turned out to be a writer later, an amateur writer. He went off to Hollywood, and his name disappeared in the pages of history somewhere. But shortly thereafter, surprise, surprise, the Indy, not Vindy, the Indiana Jones series hit the screen. And they had a big rolling rock running down this thing at him, and he was running like crazy to keep from getting hit by it. And, you know, many of the little things that did happen appeared in that first movie. So,
Andy was incidentally also looking for the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, strangely, hey. And he and I, we discovered a code together on this, on the Copper Scrolls, which was done in the old Babylonian style. In the old days, when they passed a secret message to the troops from the leader, you know, the general or the king or whatever, they couldn't just write it out, because if the guy that was carrying the message got killed, the enemy could read the message and spoil the whole surprise or secret or whatever. So they would take a cylinder, like about the size of an oatmeal box, you know these round oatmeal
Sorry, we'll get into more of this after the break. Cylinders about the size of an oatmeal box or something. We'll try and come back to that. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Stan Deo is my guest. You can go Google him. He's done a lot of work over the years, a lot of very interesting stuff and a lot of different subjects, to the point in which you could kind of cover quite a few just talking to him. We'll be right back after the break.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the breed of uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong with the world? People kill people that other people command. Middle East is a modern day attack on a native land. Project eugenics planned on the common man. Expand the military industrial complex. Annex or install you with chemical objects. Specs, the psyop attacking your conscience. Next, your brain agrees with the offense. Political.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the show that's all about depleted uranium poisoning. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Lighter side of genocide. I think that subject kind of comes off kind of self-promotional, don't you think, Stan? Sorry. Sorry about that. I'm a great believer in the principle that there's nothing shameful about shameless self-promotion.
Well, true. It pays the bills, doesn't it?
In general. So if there's anybody out there who'd actually like to call in, I'm not sure if you keen to take some calls, Dan?
Well, I'm afraid to, but let's do it.
All right. Well, the call-in number, ladies and gentlemen, is 218-339-8525. That's 218. You're dialing it in. 339-8525. So call on in. We've only got two segments left, so you're probably going to have to call in right now-ish if you want to get on air with me and Stan. Now, can I ask you, Stan, what kind of actually awakened you to, well, everybody kind of comes from their own different particular background. Some people are sort of born into a family that essentially you don't have any choice but to be an awakened individual. You know, they tell you what stuff's really about. They teach you. Other people, on the other hand, they go through life blindly being a slave, and then something wakes them up and they then get into all the other stuff. I was just wondering, what's your story?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. All of my life, basically, around, you know, Dad and Mom, we've been investigating the Illuminists, the Illuminati, the hidden government of the world. And my dad kind of started getting aware of this when he was over in North Africa. He was a base commander for the last part of the war over there when they were over in Iran or Tehran. And they were left behind by our government when the world war was over. And what happened is that Dad had to organize all of the guys that were going to go home after all the war there, had to organize them to stay and not go home and see their families. They hadn't seen some of them in a couple of years. Stay there in the old Persia, in essence, and operate an Air Force base with the British. There was two contingents there. The British had to do the same thing. Operate a base with fake patches on that from a distance looked like Army Air Force and all that kind of stuff, but they weren't there. It's a case where the government, a portion of our government, not the White House, said, you guys are on your own. If you get caught in this, we don't know you. But they used Howard Hughes and TWA to fly briefcases full of money over there once a week to pay the men to stay. And they got handsomely rewarded. But to stay there and run this fake Air Force base so that the Russians, who were there also, would not take over the Middle East oil fields after the war. Because everyone in the military knew that was what was going to happen. Even Patton had told them that, General Patton. So Dad stayed there with that year or two after the war was over, before he'd come home. He was probably the first major operation, undercover operation, before they formed the CIA, and some of the same people that had him do that were eventually forming the CIA. So he was one of the CIA founding projects, if you wish, and he came back knowing a lot more than the average peanut about what was going on worldwide, because they told him. When he tried to tell neighbors and friends this, they didn't listen, and so Dad really was a very determined individual, and he started to researching this, contacting authors, and set up a book company to start educating America about what was really happening behind the scenes and who was behind Bush, you know, number one, before he was even president. So Dad didn't get a lot of mention on the internet, but there's one article that they do quote, and it's where he was talking about, you know, Bush, and it says, "Who's Behind the Bush?" And, you know, it's a quaint title for it, but he had several million people inquire and buy books about Johnson and the cover-up and the Kennedy assassination and the Illuminati. Well, of course, I was raised in that environment. So when I left home, I went to the Air Force Academy for a while and came back, and then I got recruited by Teller's people and went down to Australia. And I did not realize that I'd been recruited to work on a flying saucer project by the same guys that my dad had been complaining about and trying to warn people about all this time. And when I did, you know, I mean, this is silly, but that's how it happened. And I kind of got the message early upon arrival there when I was met by my control officer, Captain Sir John Williams, and he was commenting about how they hated the Jews and didn't want them to sit on their share market, and that America had done a good thing by keeping them down, that kind of stuff. And apparently they hadn't done their homework because my dad was Jewish. And so I thought, whoa, I'll just kind of keep my mouth shut and see what's happening here. It wasn't very long before we had some serious discussions about my allegiance to their program. And they wanted to put me at the bottom of a mine shaft as a result of that permanently. That's how I got started.
Yeah. Nothing will get you started like a bottom of a mine shaft looming before you.
Well, yeah, it does it for you, doesn't it? Kind of gets you on the move. And I did manage to sneak off and elude the intelligence services of the United States and Russia and Australia for about 6 months before they caught me. But that was interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I was on the run from the baddest ass intelligence mofos in the world for 6 months. I'm Stan Dago, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, yes, I did manage to get away with a clever ruse and tricked them, but it doesn't last forever.
Yeah, it doesn't. And time always catches up with you.
Yeah, you know, and if it hadn't have been for the West Australian security, Australian Security Intelligence Agency, it's ASIO is what they call the acronym for it, but I probably wouldn't have made it to where I am now, but they took me under wing and were unhappy about what had been happening over on the other side of the country where I came from with their sister branch. And so with their protection, and they even assigned me a bodyguard, you know, with a 45 caliber pistol under his armpit. And with that protection, I was able to survive and eventually to come forward and write a book and do TV things to expose what was happening and to finish my father's work as best I could.
Yeah, yeah, and there's quite a number of copies of your book, The Cosmic Conspiracy, floating around here in New Zealand as well. I've met quite a number of people, you know, just randomly or whatever, when I mention your name, they're like, oh, yeah, I've read this book.
Is that right?
Yeah, man.
Well, I know we sold Cosmic Conspiracy in, let's see, English, and French, and German. We were going to do it in Koine Greek, but an earthquake clobbered the guy that was going to do that, so he couldn't finish it. I mean, his building went down. But it's probably in 25 countries of the world. And I guess it happened so long ago, back in 1978 when I first published it, that I'm still kind of amazed that people remember it, but they do. They have old tattered copies they bring out.
Well, see, that old tattered copy, you know why that copy is old and tattered is because it gets shared heaps.
Well, that's a point. That's a point.
The one book would be read by in some cases, I don't know, it could be dozens, maybe even hundreds of people. Who knows?
Well, you know, when I was in Australia, I was there for 30 years, but during the heyday of all the kerfuffle that my book caused, there was a premier of Queensland named Joe Bjelke-Petersen. Do you remember Joe? Or was that before your time?
Okay. No, no.
Well, he was.
I was born in 84, man.
Yeah, poor thing. Anyway, that was about the time all this was happening. The premier over there was very outspoken against the Illuminati, believe it or not. And he called me over to his office. I was in West Australia. He had me come over to see him there in Queensland at Government House down the basement and wanted to pick my brain on what I knew about the Illuminists and what they were up to in Australia and elsewhere, which I shared. And not long after that, I was invited back over by a group there to speak at a high school to a few hundred people in a 2 or 3 day series of lectures on the cover-up and the Illuminati and the flying saucers and anti-gravity and that kind of stuff. Now, this was before I actually wrote the book, The Cosmic Conspiracy. And Joe Bjelke, the premier there, assigned a security detail to me, plainclothesmen, to stop hecklers, anybody that would hurt me or my team or anything like that. And the church that organized the speech had under the stage a bunch of these Sony tape duplicating cassettes machines so that they could record the thing. And by the end of the lecture that day, people could buy and walk away with copies of what they'd heard. Well, that's fine. And I finished my lecture and went on back home. And they gave me an update, that church did, on the sale of those 20,000 cassettes they sold from that one lecture, and found out that many of them had gone through 15 to 20 loan outs to somebody else, to somebody else, to somebody else, just like the book you're talking about. And they'd made copies of it. So, you know, I don't know how many people it's influenced. And it kind of makes you think, what did I say on those tapes? And was everything, you know, spot on? And did I cough or, you know, just being silly? But it was so ingrained in the Australian public that when I was back home in Perth, not at, you know, in Queensland where we did the recording, I was back home, and a few months after that, maybe a couple of years, I called an electrician to come around the house to help me fix something on the switchboard. And he says, I'm on the phone. He says, oh, I know your voice. I said, you do? He said, yeah, we got your tapes. And my wife's kind of sick of hearing them because I play them all the time while I'm out working and stuff like that. Good grief. I thought, wow. So, you know, after that, I had written a book, and it got, you know, it was on the bestseller list for 2 or 3 years there in Australia. And I, as I said to you, I think probably off air, I did a show in 1995 or 96 with Art Bell. And it was the first of many on the Coast to Coast AM show. Again, talking just like you and I are talking, same voice and everything. And time passed, and a few years after I'd done that show, the first one, I had to go back to the States to visit one of our sons in Louisiana. And the airline had a treetop airline, you know, one of these little double prop jobs that that flies at night and comes in the Shreveport Airport there in Louisiana. So there was only one other guy on the flight with me as a passenger, and he was with NASA, I think. We got off talking about it. And as we disembarked from the plane, went into the airport, it was all dark. They'd shut it down for the night there in that embryonic megalopolis of Shreveport, you know, in those days. And they had security guards, you know, policemen running around inside, but that was about all they did was guard the place. So they were over there watching us get our bags, and I was talking to this guy from NASA. And one of the security guards comes over to me and, you know, gun, badge, and all that. And he says, hey, you, I know who you are. And I thought, man, you must have the wrong person. You know, am I getting arrested or what? And he says, I listen to Art Bell. I know who you are, Dale. I know that voice. And it's amazing that your voice can be as dead a giveaway as, I guess, what you look like. You know, it's just, there was half a planet away.
Yeah, humans have an amazing resonating chamber. It's unlike any other organism.
Well, I believe it now. You know, I've got another book, too, called The Vindicator Scrolls that don't sell anymore because I haven't reprinted it. It was just so expensive to print in full color and with gold embossing on the back. I did that in 89 after I got back from Israel. And that book, oh, gosh, it's been widely distributed across the planet. But now then, because of what I said in that book, on Amazon and on secondhand book sales, they're fetching somewhere up to $300 and $400 a copy for old, ragged, you know, copies of it. Mm. I guess that tells you that people think it's important what I've been trying to share with them, and that's encouraging to me because that's the only feedback I get is looking at those stats and things.
Well maybe have you got the ability to ebook them, Stan?
I am going to do that if I can just get time from our other projects that are a little bit higher priority at the moment. I've set it aside. I've got some old copies, and I've got to put it, I guess, into an EPUB or a PDF file and do that. I have been exploring the possibility.
Isn't it just like you take the manuscript that you got, like that's digital, isn't it? Like an old Word file or?
I've got a Word file, but it doesn't have the pictures embedded in it. And the picture, you know, I have the original negatives that we print a book with, which are high res, but they've got the dot pattern in them. So I'm going to have to get some of the original photographs or drawings, if I can find them, that I made the negs with. And I think I have them in a box in the back, and then rescan them and put them in. So there's a little bit of work involved in it. But so many people have asked for it and are holding on to their copies, as you can tell by the secondhand price, that I know that people want to see what's there.
It might be worth putting off your other projects, Stan.
Well, I guess what I try to do is weigh the priority, like, of things, current events that are going to affect people right now versus talking about where the Garden of Eden was and where Atlantis really was and what happened. And there's a bit about my travels in Israel and who I think the Antichrist might be, or at least a front runner for it. Because his first name is Nimrod, and he's a real person over in Israel. But, you know, when you relate that to elections and oil things and the news today, is it as important? You know, it's kind of a
fun. I was having a conversation with a guy the last night, And he said that he wanted nine hands to do all this, to do all this certain stuff at the same time. You know, he wanted to smoke a ciggy and drink coffee and have a beer and and do all this other stuff all at the same time. And in a way, when you're a truther and you're covering a lot of different diverse topics, you kind of feel like that a little bit, as if you wanted extra hands or copies of yourself. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Stan Deo. And, well, it's very strange, you know, Stan. I live life every day like it's my last. And if today was my last day interviewing you, hey, that's not too bad.
Hey, thank you for that. Now, when we left for the break, I was talking about oatmeal boxes and secret seals and stuff. You want to, you want me to pick that up? Okay, let's take a simpler example, a can of tomato soup. You know, it's just a can-shaped thing about that size. But it was made out of solid clay, and these Babylonian, in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, they had these. And what they would do is they would take this can-shaped piece of clay, and they would use their cuneiform tablets, you know, scribes have things to make the tablets. They would punch little messages along this the sides of this can or this can-shaped clay. Now, what people thought was the enemy, if they grabbed that, is that they would take it and try to read it and see what the secret message was. And what they would read openly would be, you know, okay, I have 40 cans of beans and 10 men over in that part there, and nothing really important. But yet, the secret was, if you took that round cylinder-shaped secret message and you rolled it across fresh wet clay tablet, rolled it until it made one full revolution, only certain letters or shapes or drawings would imprint into the clay if you pressed it lightly, and all the other letters would drop out. And that's what happened with the copper scrolls. They were done that way so that certain letters were deeper embedded in the copper than others, and a map was in there that looked like part of scratching or some damage to the scroll, so someone reading it wouldn't actually see the truth unless they were able to roll that out. And that's what we did with Photoshop and graphics, and Dr. Jones and I found some incredible stuff in there about the great treasure of Solomon that was hidden in the temple, and where it was hidden and how, and that kind of stuff that you can't get to today. But using that technique, it was an interesting document to translate, and he and I spent a number of months on that, a year or two, I guess, finding out various parts of it and sharing it back and forth. And so, in essence, I was like Dr. Jones's remote helper, because I was down in Australia at the time, and we both got a big hoot out of the shows that Spielberg and Lucas produced on that subject. Obviously, Hollywood and fun and a bit camp, but we did do our time trying to set the record straight on some of the archaeology, and I think the real Dr. Jones, Dr. Bendel Jones, did do a great deal toward uncovering the secrets of the ancient past in the Middle East.
The ancient past in the Middle East. So what's the future for us, Stan, here? I mean, in terms of your particular life. In fact, I want to change the subject a little bit here, because I kind of have this question that I try to ask my guests during the last segment of the show. We all self-censor a little bit. Sometimes we hold our tongues about certain things because, you know, people might think it's a bit risque, or it might be inappropriate, or the conversation just doesn't wind up going there, or for some reason or another, there's things that we don't normally say, and let alone get the opportunity to say on radio without, you know, feeling like we might be judged or anything. So at this point in time, that's where I'd like you to divulge, and if there's anything of that nature, go for your life.
If there's anything of that nature, you want to just encapsulate that again for me in a sentence or a question?
If there's anything you don't normally talk about because, you know, you don't think people will get it?
Oh, gosh, where do I start? There are things like in technology that is suppressed technology. There are things in cosmology, how the universe works, that are a little cerebral, and I have to use videos and animations or and drawings to explain that to people, because if I wave my hands a lot, it doesn't help much. It's, you know, hand waving. It's not drawings and animations of what's really happening out there. I don't discuss the finer details of how to make anti-gravity on air, because the number of terrorists and crazies out there that could use something like that to advantage really says that that's not wise. There are things that I've been researching in ancient history, the history of the Christian and Jewish movements, and the history before that on the earth in the archaeological record, which are things that I'm still trying to rationalize and put into coherent discussions that I don't talk about yet, because it's kind of like going off half-cocked on a story, and it could mislead people. So, yeah, there are things like that. There are names that I don't divulge over the air, you know, agents that I've worked with in intelligence, or even one or two Illuminists that have helped me in spite of their major conviction to support the Illuminati. Yeah, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't discuss some of the techniques I use to in my escape from the intelligence agencies. Most of them, parts of them, have been seen in movies since then, but I don't discuss how I use them, because I might have to use them again.
Yeah, you didn't do like Shawshank Redemption style and tunnel out with like a rock hammer out of 20 years or something.
No, not quite. But yeah, learned a lot. Learned about human psychology in the process and how to work it to your advantage. It's a little bit like, what was it? 3 Days of the Condor. When you're on the run, you have to think pretty quick and use to your advantage your current props and things that are around you and people, you know, random things. So that's what I did.
I feel that sometimes when you're living a life that's full of excitement and adventure and what have you, the little things don't seem to matter anymore. Like stuff starts to pile up, and you get this kind of clutter because you don't think it really matters that much having a clean house or something like that, is because your perspective really does change and you start to notice what's actually really important, and you set about spending your energy trying to accomplish those things.
Well said. That's it. I mean, I could show you my office here where things pile up in stacks, you know, and I need more shelves to put more stacks on, and they sit there and gather dust sometimes. But yeah, you do prioritize things very rapidly, like breathing and, you know, eating and having no bullet holes in you and stuff like that. You know, you do tend to do that.
Yeah. And I was wondering, you know, it comes down to the choice, really. Whether or not you want to spend as much time as you can entertaining yourself, or whether or not you recognize that entertainment isn't just entertainment, isn't just helping you to unwind or relax or anything. What it is, in fact, starting to be is something that's available to you all the time. So it ceases to be an entertainment that gives you a break from normality. It starts to be a distraction that disrupts normality.
Good
and
grief.
We don't finish things that we start a lot of the time. We have all these great ideas, and the average person comes up with like, what was it, like $2 to $3 million ideas a day, and they never have the time or the effort or the manpower or the resources, in a lot of these cases, to fulfill any of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know whether it's 2 or 3 times a day. Some people, they look like they're not really tuned in. They're kind of tuned out to life, you know, walk through like zombies. But I'm sure there are a great number of people that have good ideas, as you say, and who are alert.
I'm astounded constantly at the amount of lazy people who have really good ideas.
That's where the good ideas come from.
Yeah, the good ideas come from lazy people who don't want to do the work. It's like some guy sitting on the couch in 1970 and he says, man, I wish there was a way of changing the channel without getting up to the TV. Boom, the remote.
True. Yeah, well, if you look at it, lazy is the word. I mean, we got tired of you know, pulling an ox cart ourselves and invented a horse and, you know, carriage and trains and power. And we've done everything to make ourselves redundant as far as physical labor and even thinking in some degrees. I mean, look at the computer. It does it for you.
Yeah. I got tired of having to travel 10,000 miles to have a conversation with you. So, you know, Skype was invented.
Yes, yes. It's a natural progression, yes.
It's either born out of necessity or procrastination. That's right. There we go. There's the two keys to successful inventions: necessity and procrastination.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, is if you want something done, you give it to someone who's already too busy to do it and make them put it into their schedule. And certainly Holly and I are pretty busy. She's busier than I am because she gets up at 4:30 5 days a week and starts researching news all over the planet to share with people on our websites. And she handles two major websites every day that way. And so from 4:30 to about 10:30 in the morning, she's really, really working hard. And then she's got to do, you know, wifely duties and, you know, cook meals and, you know, clean house, watch doggies, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, you want it done, you give it to someone who's busy. But if I tried to give her anything else to do right now, I think she'd hit me over the head with a pan.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite business practices, MMR. Make myself redundant. If I can find a way to get it done automatically without me having to spend extra time on it, that's the way it's going to be done.
Well, that's inventive then, isn't it? You know, one of the things that really hacks me off, it has for a number of years, is that, like, we used to be able to invent things and patent them. And now that Clinton has given away our patent office to the Chinese during his administration, you know, I applied for a patent on one energy device. There was something wrong they didn't like. The patent got released into the internet and never given to me.
Oh, that sucks, man.
It does.
All right. Well, Stan Deo is my guest, ladies and gentlemen. StanDeo.com. Please, if you can, support the broadcast and the work we do here by going to TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, subscribe, donate, access the commercial-free archives. Also, after the show, we're going to be doing a video interview with Stan, so that'll also be uploaded there to TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Catch you again, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for your support. We'll see you again sometime.